Where are you from in broken English? I said, I'm from the US. And his face just filled with pain. And he grabbed my hand and he pulled me close to him. And he said, my house was destroyed. My family was killed by a missile that came from the US. And as an American, I was ashamed. I had nothing to say to him. I had no response. And all I could say is that there are still people in America who are fighting this. They're trying to stand up for you. They're speaking up for you. This is all I can promise you, that we'll keep doing that. He said, what are you doing here? I'm a physician. Are you working at the hospital? No, I just volunteered to come. The pain slowly eased and he just resigned himself. And then he said, thank you, and gave me a hug. The gratitude for someone that just cares a little bit is so deep. And it's humbling because these are people who are used to being neglected, forgotten, denied. And you've heard from everybody here, I can attest the same thing. The only thing anybody asked when you ask them, what can we do for you when we leave? Just tell everybody our story. They didn't ask for vengeance. They didn't ask for this. They didn't ask for that. All they said is, don't let anyone forget us and just tell them what's happening here, what you saw. And that's why I'm here, because I feel helpless. But I'm only here because they asked me to tell their story. And besides the devastation to human lives, I can tell you that this is annihilation of an entire society. Besides the genocide, besides the massacres, we hear bombs like rumbling thunder all day long that after a few days, you don't hear it anymore. You just become used to it. Until a week later, another person comes like, oh, what is that, bombs? Yeah, that happens all the time. And so one day I left the hospital in my 3 weeks and drove through Khan Yunis, and I actually saw what all this rumbling had done. This is not targeted strikes. This is calculated, sequential annihilation of an entire land. There is nowhere that you can go in the city where it's not leveled. Neighborhood by neighborhood by neighborhood, farmland, water plants, everything you can imagine is just leveled. And there's nowhere else to go. There's no safe camps. Nobody feels safe anywhere they go. The day I arrived, with my own eyes, I witnessed a missile strike in a safe camp in Mawasi, about 300 yards from where I was. People scattered, and after a while, they went back to see if their families were still alive. The medical students Dr. Yusuf is talking about, they come every day. The nurses, the doctors, they come to the hospital every single day, dressed like this, ready to work. And then you realize after a week, wait a second, these guys are wearing the same exact scrubs with the same stain on the pants, the same scarf, same shoes, socks, everything. And then you remember, you actually sit down and say, wait a second, every one of them is living in a tent. Every one of them has been displaced 6 or 7 times, and they still come to work every single day at the hospital to take care of people. And this medical student, there was one girl, 21 years old, her name is Dima. She was so, what we call a gunner over here. She would come to the OR, she'd ask questions and this and that. Their schools are destroyed. They have no credits, they have no classes, this is a lost year for them if, God forbid, it doesn't go past that. And she would still come every day like every other student, just dedicated and trying to work, trying to learn, trying to live their life. She's just 2 years older than my own daughter, who's at UNC Chapel Hill. She's in class, studying, thinking about her degree, what she wants to do. And this girl I'm talking to, who's nearly my daughter's age, and Dr. Yusuf and I were encouraging her to say, yeah, you know, work hard, make sure you do well in your exams and this and that. And she giggled and said, yeah, if I'm still alive. This is a kid over there who's no different than my kid over here. And this is their life every single day. They don't know what's going to happen that day. We're talking about ceasefire. I'm telling you, we're way, way too late for a ceasefire. This should have happened months and months ago. Should never have gotten to this point. We're on the wrong side of history. And we're going to learn that one day. And right now, the only thing we can do is right now stop sending arms and funding, because this is on our hands as Americans. This is on our hands. And there's no question about it. That's the only thing that we can do right now. And so it has to stop. Thank you.
That was Dr. Nabil Rana, a vascular surgeon from North Carolina. You're listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Shortly, I will air the remarks of Zaha Hassan, writer, analyst on Palestinian affairs, human rights attorney, and fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, speaking about the legal rules that are applicable to Israel's occupation of Palestine and the law and Israel-Palestine conflict resolution. But I'd like to remind you that KPFT, Houston's community station, is currently in fund drive, and because KPFT relies on your support to operate, I am asking you to please call us right now and make a tax-deductible contribution. During this membership drive, please make a gift in support of the wide variety of shows that matters more than ever on KPFT. Please give online at kpft.org or call 713-526-5738. Members are the single most important source of funding for KPFT 90.1 FM. Why don't you call right now to make your membership investment and become a part of that important source? 713-526-5738, or you can give online at kpft.org. And if you make your membership a sustaining one, you'll be supporting the station for years to come. 713-526-5738 or kpft.org. This program, Arab Voices, has been on KPFT for over 22 years, coming to you every week, covering various topics with over 1,000 expert guests appearing on this program from around the globe. I interview guests on the show, and I also attend events and lectures, record them, and air them. Several radio stations syndicate Arab Voices in different cities in the U.S. and even a couple of cities in Europe. So if you appreciate what this station has been doing, we ask you to support it and keep Arab Voices and other programs on the air. Please make that call and make a pledge of any amount, whether it's $60 or $360. Call 713-526-5738 or make a pledge online at kpft.org. Your support is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much. As I mentioned earlier, the Arab American Institute, AAI, organized special events throughout the past week in Chicago while the Democratic National Convention was being held. Several panels were held, and I am going to share now the remarks of Zaha Hassan, writer, analyst on Palestinian affairs, human rights attorney, and fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, speaking about why we don't hear about the legal rules that are applicable to Israel's occupation of Palestine from U.S. policymakers and the law and Israel-Palestine conflict resolution. Let's listen in.
And I want to talk a bit about today a couple of things. I'm going to spend my time on a couple of things that I want to share. First, I want to address why is it that we don't hear much about the legal rules that are applicable to Israel's occupation of Palestine from U.S. policymakers? Where has the law gone? Why doesn't it feature more prominently in U.S. policy? Second, I want to look at what the law actually says about Israel-Palestine conflict resolution. The International Court of Justice, or the ICJ, the judicial arm of the UN, issued a landmark decision about the legal consequences of Israel's prolonged occupation in July. Many people, maybe a lot of you, haven't heard about what that court said. In January, it also ruled on the provisional measures that have to be taken in Gaza to prevent genocide. The case was brought by South Africa. So I'm going to talk about those two cases and what they say about the legal obligations that should be a part of U.S. policy, but that aren't. So first, where has the law gone? Why don't we hear much about the legal rules that apply when it comes to Israel's occupation of Palestine? So in the context of Israel-Palestine peace and U.S. policy, international law has historically not figured prominently. For example, after World War I, when President Woodrow Wilson recognized that Arabs in the Middle East were entitled to self-determination, as a matter of policy, the U.S. deprioritized Palestinian statehood and the national aspirations of Palestinian Arabs, and instead supported the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine. And when in 1948, the U.S. actively supported the partition of Palestine into two states, one Arab and one Jewish, it did so against the wishes of 70% of the population who were Arab Palestinians, and despite the fact that only a slim majority of Jews lived in what was supposed to be the Jewish state, and it allocated 55% of the land area for the Jewish state. And while the U.S. recognized the right of Palestinian refugees who were forced out of their homes in 1948 in what became the State of Israel, three quarters of Palestinian population had been displaced in what was known as the Nakba. The U.S. did not actively pursue the return of refugees as a matter of U.S. policy, nor did it work to ensure that the establishment of an Arab state followed the U.S. recognition of a state of Israel. And so the UN partition plan has been left on the table and somewhat discarded. But it wasn't until 1993 that international law was actually viewed as an obstacle to peace in U.S. policy terms. This was when the series of agreements between Israel and the PLO were signed and known as the Oslo Accords. The Oslo Accords were viewed as a breakthrough by many at the time for a number of reasons. First, Israel had finally recognized that the Palestine Liberation Organization was the legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. Now, this was less of for the benefit of Palestinians than it was for Israel. If Israel didn't acknowledge the PLO's legal personality, then it could not expect the PLO and Palestinians to be bound by terms of any agreement. Second, the Oslo Accords set a definitive deadline for getting a comprehensive agreement on the contentious issues that needed to be resolved, including on refugees, Jerusalem status, settlements, and what the border would be. Third, the Oslo Accords also called for maintaining a status quo in the occupied territories. This would be during the negotiations, meaning there should be no settlement expansion and de facto annexation. And it stated that Gaza and the West Bank were one territorial unit. So while those were important achievements of the Oslo Accords, the Accords suffered from fatal flaws. Among them was that Oslo failed to identify the objective of negotiations. That seems crazy to us. Like, shouldn't an agreement identify what the purpose of the agreement is? But there was no mention of a Palestinian state being the goal. The other fatal problem with the Accords is that there was only one reference to international law, and it was to UN Security Council Resolutions 242 and 338, which call for an end to Israel's occupation and mutual recognition between states involved in the 1967 war. Those resolutions do not explicitly mention establishment of a state of Palestine or the rights of Palestinians. In fact, the Oslo Accords do not mention that Palestinians have any legal rights at all vis-a-vis Israel. Why didn't Palestinians demand that international law be explicitly named as the terms of reference for negotiations in the Oslo Accords? If you ask the Palestinians who negotiated the Oslo Accords, they'll tell you that if they explicitly referenced international law, Israel would never have signed the agreements and would have never engaged in negotiations. To make up for this failing, though, they said that they relied on assurances from the U.S. that it would act as an honest broker to address the imbalance of power between Israel and the Palestinian people. The U.S. had become the sole superpower, remember, at that time. And it had a special relationship with Israel that it still has today. The Palestinian negotiators took the U.S.'s word on faith. Oslo's five-year deadline passed in 1999, and over the course of the last three decades of on and off again peace talks, Israeli settlers in the West Bank and East Jerusalem went from 240,000 to more than 750,000 today. Not only did the settler population mushroom under Oslo, but on every single one of the contentious issues that Palestinians and Israelis were supposed to come to an agreement on, known as the final status issues, which include a shared Jerusalem, the borders, the status of Palestinian refugees and settlements, the U.S. took it upon itself to resolve them in Israel's favor. For example, on Jerusalem, and when negotiations were at the height of their, you know, time, Congress under the Clinton administration called for the Holy City to remain Israel's undivided capital and for the U.S. embassy to be moved to from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. This is the U.S. embassy to Israel. Trump ultimately was the president to move that embassy in 2018, and the Biden administration has kept it in place. On borders, U.S. policy since the George W. Bush administration has been that the 1967 border is only a baseline, and that adjustments should be made to take into account certain demographic realities. So U.S. policy essentially became that the ever-growing blocks of Israeli settlements should be annexed to Israel under any peace deal. And on refugees, the Obama administration made it a prerequisite for peace negotiations that Palestinians recognize Israel as a Jewish state. This effectively meant that Palestinian refugees from 1948 would not be given the choice of whether to return to their homes and property inside Israel. This position was also legally problematic for Palestinian citizens of Israel. It opened the door 2 years later for Israel to pass the Jewish nation state law, which provided that only Jewish people have a right to self-determination in the area in which Israel considers it Israel. And in his Peace to Prosperity plan, President Trump reaffirmed the positions of all these previous administrations, but he went further by deciding that Israel was entitled to annex at least a third of the West Bank and that not a single Palestinian refugee would return to Israel or resettle in the West Bank or Gaza. So considering the failure of the Oslo peace process and U.S. policy, Palestinians have tried to access legal mechanisms to advance their rights and claims. The U.S. has strongly opposed those efforts across Democrat or Republican administrations. So when Palestinians tried to make Palestine a full member of the UN to affirm the two-state solution and to be able to sit in bodies like the Security Council, the U.S. has opposed it. When Palestinians seek bilateral recognition from the remaining states in Western Europe that have yet to recognize Palestine, the U.S. uses its influence with the third states to prevent it. And when Palestinians go to the International Criminal Court to seek accountability for war crimes, or if the General Assembly seeks an advisory opinion, or third states seek a ruling from the International Court of Justice, the U.S. opposes it. Not only does the U.S. oppose Palestinian efforts or any effort toward Israeli accountability, it calls these efforts provocative unilateral actions, and it equates them with Israeli settlement construction. Now, why would recognition of Palestine as a state, which affirms the two-state solution, or seeking accountability for international crimes, be compared to settlement construction, which is actually illegal and a war crime, and is meant to destroy the two-state solution? The U.S. argues that they both prejudice negotiations. Now, that explanation is really hard to accept, given what I just explained about how U.S. administrations have bit by bit chipping at the final status positions of Palestinians on issues like Jerusalem, refugee rights, and settlements, etc. That certainly prejudices negotiations, but against Palestinians. Not only has U.S. policy prejudiced final status issues between Israelis and Palestinians, it infringes on international law, it legitimizes violations of Palestinian rights, and it destroys the possibility for a two-state solution. So, I've talked about why the law has been undermined by U.S. policy, but what does the law actually require? So the ICJ's recent advisory opinion of last month on Israel's prolonged occupation and its ruling in January on the case brought by South Africa under the Genocide Convention are instructive. In December 2022, the UN General Assembly asked the World Court, this is the judicial arm of the United Nations, for a legal opinion on what were or what are the legal consequences arising from the policies and practices of Israel in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem, and how does it affect the legal status of the occupation. Here are the points that are most important for us to understand about that opinion. Number one, it said that Gaza is occupied territory, and it's been occupied territories even after 2005, when Israel redeployed troops to the perimeter of Gaza while maintaining a siege and blockade over Palestinians there. It said that Israel's policies, its discriminatory practices, its Jewish settlements, its home demolitions, its two-tiered legal system, one for Palestinians and the other for Jewish settlers, amounts to annexation, it's illegal, and it's a crime of apartheid. It said that all settlers must be evacuated from the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and that Israel must withdraw from the occupied territories immediately. No negotiations, none of that talk about Israel's security. It needs to happen immediately. Now, it's up to the General Assembly to advise member states, international organizations, and the UN system on the obligations that flow from this World Court decision. But we should be under no illusions here. U.S. policy is unlikely to change because the ICJ opinion, which is advisory in nature, is not legally binding, even though it's a statement of law. The U.S. explained in its brief to the ICJ that it opposed the UN General Assembly seeking the legal advice of the World Court because it said doing so, quote, risks driving the parties further away from the objective of a two-state solution, unquote. It's important to recall that at the time the U.S. opposed the General Assembly's referral to the ICJ, Israel had just formed a new coalition government that included two ultra-nationalist racist politicians, one of whom had plans for the voluntary, quote, voluntary removal of Palestinians from the West Bank. And when the U.S. submitted its written brief to the court, the ICJ had found already that there was a plausible case of genocide taking place in Gaza. Now, it's hard to imagine how seeking enforcement of international law in fora such as the Security Council or the World Court makes matters more difficult between Israelis and Palestinians. In fact, I would argue that the best chance for a negotiated political solution lies in disincentivizing Israel's violations of international law by ensuring that there's accountability for Israeli violations. The U.S. also wrote in its brief that the only way to end the occupation is through bilateral negotiations that address Israel's security concerns. The problem with this position is that it gives Israel veto power to indefinitely maintain its occupation. In fact, in 2014, Secretary of State John Kerry expressed, quote, total confidence that Israel's security requirements could be met with a plan that he and General John Allen prepared at that time. Yet, Netanyahu refused to even consider the plan, demanding that Israel maintain overarching security control over the West Bank forever. Later, Kerry wrote in his memoir that it was clear, quote, Bibi was not interested in actually addressing the security questions in a way that could allow for the eventual withdrawal of the IDF, that's the Israeli army. He concluded, quote, this wasn't about security. And for 8 years, it still isn't about security. It's about colonizing the occupied territories and displacing Palestinians. And now, with regard to the case brought by South Africa at the ICJ, alleging Israel is committing a genocide in Gaza, the case on the merits has not been decided. But in January, the ICJ ruled that South Africa had made out a plausible case that genocide's taking place. The court's provisional measures ruling called on Israel to stop all killing of Palestinians without qualification. Arguably, you can't do that without a total ceasefire, though the court did not explicitly call for one. The court also said that Israel had to take immediate and effective measures to allow humanitarian assistance into Gaza to prevent starvation and death. Again, this is impossible to do without a total ceasefire. And finally, the court called on Israel to end its genocidal incitement. In light of the ICJ's ruling on provisional measures, the U.S. is obligated to stop its offensive weapons transfers to Israel. The U.S. is a signatory to the Genocide Convention and has accepted to prevent and punish the crime of genocide. Failing to stop the weapons transfers to Israel following that ICJ ruling could make the U.S. complicit in genocide. The U.S. has also recognized ICJ rulings on provisional measures cases are legally binding. It did so in the context of the case that was brought between Ukraine and Russia. However, there is no sign that the U.S. is considering to stop offensive weapons transfers, as you all probably know. In fact, the U.S. has accelerated deliveries and increased the amount of weapons to Israel above the $3.8 billion per year Israel receives. The EU and the UK are considering holding back weapons to Israel in light of the ICJ decision. If they take such a decision, it would put pressure on the U.S. to take some action as well to suspend weapons to Israel. Certainly, continuing to supply weapons to Israel while other countries institute an embargo would lend support for allegations that the U.S. is complicit in genocide. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
That was Zaha Hassan, writer, analyst on Palestinian affairs, human rights attorney, and fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. You're listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Did you know that this program, Arab Voices, has been on the air since April 2002? That's over 22 years of weekly Arab Voices programming, over 1,000 programs covering different topics with more than 1,000 expert guests appearing on the show from around the globe. All of that has been possible because of your support to KPFT, Houston's community station, our community radio station. And it is time for the fund drive. Please call right now to support KPFT at 713-526-5738 and make a tax-deductible contribution or make it online at kpft.org. Every dollar counts. Think of the value you get out of KPFT and really for everyone who listens. We know that not everyone can contribute, but if you can and appreciate what KPFT brings you every day, please consider a pledge because KPFT relies on you, the listeners, for support. The phones are open. There is room for your call. Help keep up the momentum. Call 713-526-5738 or donate online at kpft.org. Thank you very much. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.
Radio Lora, 97.5 MHz. Am I a terror?